The envoy's delicate health had taken great benefit from Bombay, and after his week of seasickness, his strength and spirits recovered remarkably. He and Stephen often sat together, hearing one another their Malay verbs, or rehearsing his address to the Sultan of Kampong. It was to be delivered in French, a language that Mr. Stanhope did not possess in great perfection. Nor, it was to be presumed, did the Sultan, but there was a French resident at Kampong, and Mr. Stanhope felt that for his master's credit he must be word perfect. And they went through it again and again, breaking down every time, and roi de 36 parapluies, et très illustre seigneur de 1000 éléphants. Mr. Stanhope transposing the seigneur and the elephants out of mere nervousness. The address was to be translated phrase by phrase into Malay by his new Oriental secretary, a gentleman of mixed parentage from Bencoolen, found for the envoy by the governor of Bombay. Mr. Atkins looked upon the new arrival with hatred and suspicion. He tried to make Mr. Ahmed Smythe's life miserable, but outwardly at least he was unsuccessful. For in the Oriental secretary the Malay predominated, and his large, black, somewhat oblique eyes shone with merriment. Mr. Stanhope tried to keep the peace between them, but often and often Atkins's harsh, nasal voice would be heard issuing from the cabin. Little or no privacy in a vessel 30 yards long with 200 men crammed into it, complaining of some infringement of his prerogatives, some slight. And then the envoy's gentle, conciliating murmur, assuring him Smythe was a very good, well-behaved, civil, attentive fellow, that he meant no harm, had no idea of encroaching. Ahmed Smythe was popular in the ship. Although, being a Mohammedan and suffering from his liver, he drank no wine. And when the rearrangement of the frigate's bowels set free a space long enough to swing a hammock in, Mr. Stoughton had it screened off as a cabin for the foreign gentleman. This so vexed Atkins, who was obliged to share with poor Mr. Barclay, with whom he was no longer on speaking terms, that he came to Stephen and begged him to use his influence with the captain to put an end to a gross injustice, a monstrous abuse of authority. "I cannot interfere with the running of the ship," said Stephen. "Then H.E. will have to have a word with Aubrey himself," said Atkins. "It's intolerable. Every day this nigger finds some new way of provoking me. If he don't take care, I shall provoke him, I can tell you." "Do you mean you'll fight him?" asked Stephen. "That is a course no one with your welfare at heart could advise." Thank you, Dr. Matcham," cried Atkins, grasping his hand. He was extremely sensitive to even the most fallacious appearance of affection, poor man. "But that is not what I meant. Oh, no. A man of my family doesn't fight with a half-caste nigger clerk, not even a Christian. After all, gentilhomme est toujours gentilhomme." "Compose yourself, Mr. Atkins," said Stephen, for the enthusiasm with which Atkins spoke these last words brought the blood to his nose and ears. "In these latitudes, indulgence in passion may bring on a calenture. I do not like your mottled face. You eat too much, drink too much, and are a likely victim." Yet it was Mr. Stanhope that suffered from the calenture. One afternoon, when Ahmed Smythe dined with the gunroom, Atkins could be heard ranting away in the cabin. Some feet above the open skylight, the carpenter rested his mallet and said privately to his mate, "If I was His Excellency, I should put that bugger into the jolly boat with a pound of cheese and bid him look out for another place." "How he does badger and worry the poor old gent, to be sure. You'd think they was married. I feel for him, poor old gent. Always a civil word." A little later, Mr. Stanhope's valet brought his master's compliments. He begged to be excused from their party at whist, and would be most grateful for a word with Dr. Maturin at his leisure. Stephen found him looking tired and old and discouraged. It was this wretched bile again, he thought, and should be infinitely obliged for half of a blue pill or whatever Dr. Maturin judged proper. A thready, uneven pulse, a high temperature, dry skin, an anxious face, a brilliant eye. Stephen prescribed bark, his favourite slime draught, and a blue-coloured placebo. They had some effect, and Mr. Stanhope was more comfortable in the morning. Yet his strength did not return, nor his appetite. Stephen was not pleased with his patient, whose temperature rose and fell, with an alternation of febrile excitement and languor that he'd never seen before. Mr. Stanhope found the heat very hard to bear, yet every day they drew nearer to the equator, and every day the wind died to the smallest breeze between 10 and 2. They set up a windsail for him to direct the air into the cabin, where he lay dry, thin, yellow, suffering from continual nausea, but always polite, always grateful for any attention, apologetic. Stephen and M'Alister had a fair library of books on tropical medicine. They read them through and through, and admitted to one another, but in Latin, that they were at sea.
"There is at least one thing we can do," observed Stephen. "We can get rid of one external source of irritation."
Mr. Atkins was forbidden the cabin on doctor's orders, and Stephen spent most of his nights there, generally accompanied by the valet or Mr. White. He was fond of the envoy. He wished him very well. But above all, he was professionally committed. This was a case in which close Hippocratic attention must take the place of drugs. The patient was too weak, the disease too little understood for any radical measures. And he sat by Mr. Stanhope's bedside, watch after watch, while the ship moved quietly through the phosphorescent sea. This, he reflected, was his true occupation. This, not the self-destructive pursuit of a woman far beyond his reach. Medicine, as he saw it, was largely impersonal, and although its effect might be humane, Atkins would have received much the same care. What were his motives? Beyond a desire for knowledge, an itch for cataloguing, measuring, naming, recording? His mind wandered away, losing itself in intricate paths. And when he found that his half-waking consciousness was suffused with a rosy pleasure, and that there was a smile upon his face, he brought up his vague ideas with a jerk, to find that, in fact, between 2 bells and the 3 that had just struck, he had been musing upon Diana Villars. Or rather, upon her laughter, particularly bubbling and gay, unaffectedly musical, and the way the hair curled at the nape of her neck. "Did you do the Otontimoro Minos at school?" whispered Mr. Stanhope.
"I did too," said Stephen.
"But at sea it's different. I was dreaming of Dr. Bulkley at school and his terrible black face. I really thought I saw him there in the cabin. How he frightened me when I was a little chap. But, however, we're at sea, it's different. Tell me, is it nearly daylight yet? I thought I heard 3 bells.
Very soon now. Just raise your head, will you, now, till I turn your pillow.
Fresh sheets. Sponging. A spoonful of animal soup, swords removed from his cracked lips, black in the candlelight.
At four bells, Mr. Stanhope fell into a rambling account of the etiquette at the Sultan's court. Mr. Smythe told him the Malay rulers were very particular about precedence. His Majesty's representative must not give way to any improper claim. He hoped he should do right. Sponging. A change of position. The small personal ignominies. Mr. Stanhope was as shamefaced as a girl. Day after day, Stephen felt the balance shift and vary. But after a fortnight of unremitting care, he walked into the sick bay, his eyes sunk and dark-rimmed with fatigue, and said, "Mr. McAllister, a good morning to you. I believe we may cry Io Triumphe, at least as far as the anorexia is concerned. We had a pretty crisis at four, with a laudable exudation, and a little after six the patient took 11 ounces of animal soup. It is the animal soup that bears the bell away, the animal soup forever. A vicious anomaly of the pulse remains, and the palpable liver, but I think we may look forward to a gain in weight and strength." By day they slung his cot on the weather side of the quarter-deck, and the surprises were happy to see him again. He and his people and his baggage, presents and livestock had been a great nuisance to them these 15,000 miles now. But, as they said, the Excellency was a civil gentleman. Always had a civil word, not like some touch-me-not sodomites, and they were used to him. They liked what they were used to, and they rejoiced to see him getting better as the frigate slipped away south and eastwards through stronger, cooler winds. Much fresher winds and more uncertain. Sometimes they fairly boxed the compass. And now it was no unusual thing for the Surprise to strike her topgallant masts down on deck, hand her courses, and proceed under close-reefed topsails alone. It was on such a day as this, a Sunday with Jack dining in the gunroom, where the conversation was running on the wild beasts to be met with in Java, whose western tip, the opening of the Sunda Strait, they hoped to raise on Monday, that Mr. Stanhope's valet rushed in, his face horrified and distraught. Stephen left his plate. A few minutes later he sent for Mr. McAllister. Already rumours were flying round the ship. The envoy had been struck down by the strong fives, or apoplexy. He had choked over his wine, and blood, thick blood, was gushing black from his mouth. He was to be opened by the surgeon within the hour, and the instruments were sharpening this minute. He was dead. When he came back to the damped, silent, apprehensive feast, Stephen sat to his meal, and eating it up with no apparent emotion, he said to Jack, "We have taken the first measures, and he is relatively comfortable. But his state is very grave, and it is essential that he should be set down on land, the nearest firm land. And until we can reach it, the motion of the ship should be reduced as far as possible. Another 24 hours of this bucketing must have a fatal issue. May I trouble you for the wine?" "Mr. Harrowby, Mr. Pullings, pray come with me," said Jack, throwing down his napkin. "Mr. Stoughton, you'll excuse us." In a few moments all the sea officers had gone, leaving only Etheridge and the purser. They pushed the cheese towards Stephen, the pudding and the wine, watching silently and uneasily as he made his hearty meal. Jack stood at the charts, with Pullings and the master beside him. The ship's course had been altered, to bring the wind on her quarter, and she was lasking along with an easy motion under little more than her foretopsail. The latest logboard readings had been fetched, and her position was clearly and certainly set down. 5°13' south, 103°37' east, Java Head beating west-southwest 70 leagues. "We could fetch Ben Coolin on this tack," he said, "but not in 24 hours. Or bear up for Telangjang. No, not with this cross, see? Does he need a civilized town, a hospital, or will any land answer? That's the point." "I'll find out, sir," said Pullings. And coming back, he said, "Any land at all," he says. "Thank you, Pullings. You know these waters. You must have run through the straits a dozen times. Have you anything to suggest?" "Pula Batak, sir," said Pullings at once, touching the coast of Sumatra with the dividers. "Inside Pulo Batak. We watered there twice in the Lord Clive, both coming and going. It's a right bold shore, 40 fathom water, not a cable's length from the land, and a clean bottom. At the head of the bay there's a stream comes out of the rock. Sweet water you can fill directly into the boats. It ain't civilized. Nothing but some little naked black men that beats drums in the woods, but it's purely calm, and the island shelters it from anything but a nor'wester." "Very well," said Jack, hanging over the chart. "Very well. Mr. Harrowby, lay off the course for Pula Batak, if you please." He went on deck to see what sail she could bear and still remain on a fairly even keel. At midnight he was still there, and at dawn. And as the wind failed, so the surprise silently blossomed, sail by sail, into a pyramid of whiteness. They needed every ounce of thrust to reach Pula Batak in 24 hours. Their noon altitude showed a fair day's run, and a little after dinner time, no pipes, no drum, they made their landfall. Pullings at the Four Royal Jacks was certain of it. A rounded head with two peaks bearing northeast. The ship ghosted along on the unruffled sea, her lofty skysails giving her 4 knots. There was also the strange attraction of the land heaving her in, and presently the whole of the eastern sky was barred with dark mountains, growing greener as she stood on and on. The island guarding the little bay was clear from the deck, with a hint of gentle surf on its westward face, and it looked very much as though the surprise would drop her anchor within the time laid down. There was still an hour to go. The best bower was already at the Cathead, and all was cleared away when the land breeze set untimely in, coming off strong and gusty, and bringing with it the strong scent of rotting vegetation. The sail slackened, flapped, and her way began to fall off. Jack sent for the deep sea line. It splashed into the sea far forward, and running aft down the side came the familiar cry, strangely muted, "Watch, watch, bear away, veer away." And at last the answer he'd expected, "No ground, sir. No ground with 200 fathom. "All boats away, Mr. Starton," he said. "We must tow her in. Let's hope we reach soundings before the tide sets too strong against us. Mr. Rattray, bend another shot of cable to the small bower, if you please, and rouse out the new 8-inch hawser." Pullings took her in, conning the ship from the 4-yard arm. And when the ebb began to run so hard against them that the boats could no longer give her any headway at all, they dropped the small bower in a prodigious depth, something over 90 fathoms to hold their ground. This was deeper water than Jack had ever anchored in. And in his anxiety he asked Thomas Pullings if he knew what he was about. "Mr. Pullings, are you happy about our berth?" They were standing immediately above the hawse hole, with a group of extremely grave forecastlemen, old, experienced seamen, behind them. "Yes, sir," said Pullings. We rode here 3 days in the Clive. I'm sure of the bearings, and the bottom is as clean as Gurnard Point. If we veer out to the bitter end, I'll answer for it.
"Below there!" cried Jack down the hatch. "Double the stoppers, clap on two dogs, and veer out to the bitter end."
The Surprise was going fast astern. The cable straightened, rising in a drooping curve, and dragging the anchor over the seabed far below. A fluke dug into the bottom, dragged a little further, and held firm. The cable rose again, much higher, much straighter, and as it took the full strain, it stretched taut, squirting water, and then brought her up riding steady. Throughout the tide, Pullings stood there, the responsibility heavy on him, watching the cable and the shore, keeping 3 tall trees in a line, to make sure she didn't move, drift helplessly out to sea, out to the strong current that set northwest up the coast, so that they might have to beat up for days before they reached the bay again. The ebb ran faster, even faster, gurgling round her stem.
"I never heard of an anchor holding well nigh a peak, not in 100 fathom water," observed an elderly hand. "It stands to reason on account of the compression of volume."
"You pipe down, Wilkes," cried Pullings, turning sharp upon him, "you and your goddamn volumes."
"Which I only passed the remark," said Wilkes, but very quietly. How cruel fast it ebbed. But it was slackening, surely it was slackening.
Babington joined him on the forecastle. "What's o'clock?" asked Pullings.
"It wants 5 minutes of half-tide," said Babington. Together they stared at the cable. "But it is slackening faster already," he said. And Pullings felt his heart warm to him. After a moment, Babington went on, "We're to buoy the cable and slip as soon as we can tow again. They're making a kind of litter to pass him over the side in." The ebb ran its course at last. The barge pulled out with the towline, buoying the cable in its way, and Pullings went aft, feeling young once more.
"Are you ready there below, Mr. Stourton?" called Jack.
"All ready, sir,"
came the muffled reply. "Then slip the cable. Mr. Pullings, take the jolly boat and lead in. Boats away and stretch out there, do you hear me?" They stretched out, they pulled with a will, and the frigate towed sweetly. But even so, it was late evening before she glided past the island, down the sheltered inlet, with its tall, jungle-covered sides, green cliffs or bare rock rising sheer from the water, down to the far end where there was a little white crescent of beach, and an astonishing waterfall plunging down the black rocks to one side of it, almost the only sound in that strangely oppressive air. The land, which had seemed so green and welcoming from a distance, took on altogether another appearance as they drew in, and 200 yards from the shore a swarm of black flies settled heavily on the ships and the boats, crawling about the rigging, the sails, the deck, and the people. 30 hours, not 24, had gone by before they lifted Mr. Stanhope's litter out of the barge and set it gently down on the sand. The little beach seemed even smaller to Jack as he walked about it. The jungle pressed in on all sides. Huge, improbable fronds overhung the sea-rack, and the still air, no land breeze here in this lost inlet, was filled with the smell of decay and the hum of mosquitoes. He'd heard the sound of a drum in the forest as they came in, and now that his ears were accustomed to the roar of the waterfall, he heard it again, some way inland and to the north. But there was no telling how far off. A troop of fruit bats, each 5 feet across, flew low over the open space and into a vast, creeper-covered tree. Following their sinister flight, he thought he saw a dark, man-sized form moving through the mass of green below, and he stepped eagerly towards it. But the jungle wall was impenetrable, the only paths being tunnels 2 or 3 feet high. He turned and looked out over the strand and to sea. They'd rigged 2 tents, and a fire was burning, bright already in the twilight. A top lantern had been set up, and Etheridge was posting his marines. Beyond the tents lay the ship, no more than a cable's length away, but still in 20-fathom water. She was moored fore and aft to trees on the outward-curving shores, and they'd laid out the best bower to seaward. She looked huge and tall in this confined space. And lights were moving about on the main deck behind her open ports. Beyond her rose the island, blocking out the sea. She would lie safe there, even if it came on to blow, and her guns commanded every approach. But he had an uneasy feeling of being watched. And presently he moved down towards the tents. "Mr. Smythe," he said, meeting the Oriental secretary, "have you been here before?"
"No, sir," said Smythe. "This is not a part of the country the Malays frequent. Oh, no. It belongs to the Orang Bakuta, little black naked people. There. You can hear their drums. They communicate with drums."
"Aye, I dare say.
Is the doctor with his patient?"
"No, sir. He is in the other tent, preparing his instruments."
"Stephen, may I come in?" he said, ducking under the doorway. "What's your news?" Stephen tested the edge of his catlin, shaving the hair from his forearm, and said,
"We shall operate as soon as light enough, if his strength recovers a little in the night. I have represented to him the alternatives. The delicacy of such an intervention in a body worn by disease, the inevitably fatal outcome of delay. He has made his mind up to the operation as a matter of duty. Mr. White is with him now. I wish his resolution may not falter. I shall require 2 more chests and some leather-bound rope."
It was not Mr. Stanhope's resolution that faltered, but his vital spirit. All night the noises of the jungle kept him from sleep. The drums on either side of the bay disturbed his mind. The motionless heat was more than he could bear. And towards 3 in the morning he died, talking quietly about the ceremonies of the Sultan's court, and the importance of yielding to no improper claim. The drums and his official reception having, as it were, run into one another. He had little real notion of dying. Through the remaining hours of darkness, Stephen and the chaplain sat with him, listening to the noises outside the tent. The croaking and chuckling of innumerable reptiles, unidentified and countless shrieks, hoots, grunts, against a deep background of steady sound, the roar of a tiger, frequently repeated from different places, the continually shifting drums, now close, now far. They buried him in the morning at the head of the bay, with the marines firing volleys over his grave, and the ship thundering out an envoy's salute, raising clouds of birds and flying foxes all round the reverberating cove. All the officers attended in full dress, their swords reversed, and most of the ship's company. Jack took advantage of their sheltered anchorage to correct the frigate's trim. And while this was going forward, the carpenter made a wooden cross. They painted it white. And before the paint was dry, the Surprise stood out to sea, her cables recovered and stowed in the tier, smelling of the mephitic ooze. Jack looked out of the stern window at the distant, receding land, dull purple now, with a rainstorm beating down on it. He said, "We came on a fool's errand." Stephen said, as though in reply, All of a piece throughout, thy chase had a beast in view. Thy wars brought nothing about, thy lovers were all untrue."
"But still,"
said Jack after a long pause, "but still, we are homeward bound. Homeward bound at last. I'm afraid I'm required to touch at Calcutta, but it will be touch and go. Calcutta fare thee well, and home as fast as she'll fly. Indeed," he added, having reflected for a while, for a whistling pause, "if we start to fly this very moment, we might yet overhaul the China fleet and send our packets off. They're slow, close-reefed, topsails every night, old tubs, for all their man-of-war airs and graces." "You shouldn't have said that about lovers, Stephen."
Chapter 9. It was in latitude 89 east that the frigate caught them. A string of lights had been seen towards the end of the middle watch, and as the sun came up, most of the Surprise's people were on deck to contemplate the cloud of sails that stretched along the horizon. 39 ships and a brig in 2 separate bodies. They'd scattered somewhat in the night, and now they were closing up in response to their Commodore's signals, the laggards crowding sail on the moderate northeast breeze. The leeward division, if such a wandering heap could be called a division, was made up of country ships bound for Calcutta, Madras, or Bombay, and some foreigners who joined them for safety from pirates and to profit by their exact navigation. It straggled for 3 miles along the distant sea. But those to windward, all 16 of them, the larger kind of Indiaman that made the uninterrupted voyage from Canton to London, were already in a formation that wouldn't have done much discredit to the Navy.
"And are you indeed fully persuaded that they are not men of war?" asked Mr. White. "They look wonderfully like, with their rows of guns, wonderfully like to a landsman's eye."
"They do they not?" said Stephen. "It's their study so to appear, but I believe that if you look closer you will see water butts placed, stowed between the guns, and a variety of bales on deck which would never be countenanced in the service, and the various flags and streams that fly in the appropriate places are quite different. I'm not prepared to say just in what the difference lies, but to the seaman it is instantly apparent. They are not the royal insignia. Then again you will have noticed that the captain has given orders to close them, which I conceive he would scarcely have done had they been an enemy fleet of such magnitude. He said, 'Keep your laugh,' and followed it with an oath," said the chaplain, narrowing his eyes. "It is all one," said Stephen. "They speak in tropes at sea." From his perch in the main crosstrees, Pullings summoned William Church aloft, a very small midshipman in his first voyage, who seemed rather to have shrunk than to have grown in the course of it. "Now, Yunker," he said, "you're always nattering about the wealth of the Orient and the way you've never seen none of it in Bombay nor parts east, but only mud and flies and a mortal lot of sea. Well, now, just take a look through this spyglass at the ship wearing the pendant. She's the Lushington,
I made 2 voyages in her. Then, next astern, there's the Worley. A very sweet sailor. Works herself almost, and fast for an Indiaman. Trim lines. You could take her for a heavy frigate if you hadn't been aboard. You see, they carry 4 staysails just as we do. They're the only merchantman you'll ever see with a 4 staysail. Some call it impertinence. And then the one with the topsail trip that they're making such a cock of trimming. Jude has traced for the Hornchurch fair. They've forgotten to pass the staysail sheet. You see, the mate and the passion are running along the gangway. I can hear him from here. It's always the same with these Lascars. They're tolerable good seamen sometimes, but they forget their ABC. And they can't be got to do their duty brisk. No, not if it's ever so. Then on her quarter, with the patched inner jib, that's the Hope. Or maybe she's the Ocean. They're much of a muchness. Out of the same yard and off of the same draft. But anyway, all of them you see in this weather line is what we call 1,200 tonners. That'd be sure some gauge is 13 and even 1,500 ton Thames measurement. Wexford there, with her brass forecastle 8 pound a winking in the sun, she does. But we call her a 1,200 ton ship. Sir, might it not be simpler to call her a 1,500 ton ship? Simpler maybe, but it'd never do. You don't want to be upset in the old ways. Oh, dear me, no. God's my life, if the captain was to hear you carrying on in that reckless, Jacobin, democratical line, why, I dare say he'd turn you adrift on a 3-inch plank with both your ears nailed down to it to learn you bashfulness. The way he served 3 young gentlemen in the med. No, no, you don't want to go arsing around with the old ways. The French did so, and look at the scrape it's gotten them into. But what I called you up here for was to show you this here wealth of the Orient. Just you look ahead of the Commodore to the leading ship, Ganges, if I don't mistake, and now cast your eye to old Slow Belly in the rear, setting his t'gallants and sagging to leeward something cruel. Look hard now, because you'll not likely see such a sight again. For there you have a clear 6 millions of money, not counting the officers' private ventures. 6 million of money. God love us, what a prize. The officers who were wafting this enormous treasure across the ocean in their leisurely East India fashion were well rewarded for doing so. This pleased them, because, among other things, it allowed them to be magnificently hospitable, and they were the most hospitable souls afloat. No sooner had Captain Muffet, the Commodore, made out the frigate's tall mainmast in the light of dawn, than he sent for his chief steward, his head Chinese, and his head Indian cook. And signals broke out aboard the Lushington. The one, to the surprise, request honour of captains and officers' company to dinner. The other, to the convoy, all ships, pretty young female passengers required dine frigates officers. Repeat, young, repeat, pretty. The surprise ran within a cable's length of the Lushington. Boats plied to and fro along the fleet, bringing young women in silk dresses and eager officers in blue and gold. The Indiaman's splendid stateroom was filled with people, filled with cheerful noise, news of Europe, of India and the farther east, news of the war, of common acquaintances, gossip, inane but cheerful conversation, riddles, toasts to the Royal Navy, to the Honourable East India Company, to trade's increase, and the frigate's officers filled themselves with splendid food, with charming wine. Mr. Church's neighbour, a lovely rounded creature with golden hair, treated him with the attentive respect due to his uniform, urging him to try a little more of this lacquer duck, a trifle of pork, a few more slices of pineapple, calling for Canton buns, exchanging her 3rd plate of pudding with him no one would notice. But even her overflowing goodwill sought to restrain his hand at last. It sought in vain. Church,
had secured to himself a cake in the form of the Kuan Yin Pagoda. There were 8 stories still to go, and his beloved captain's motto was "Lose not a minute." He lost none in small talk at all events, but silently ate on and on. She looked anxiously round, gazed at the frigate's surgeon sitting in moody silence opposite her, but found no help. When the ladies withdrew, instantly followed by Babington, who muttered something about his handkerchief being left in the boat, she paused by the Lushington's chief officer and said, "Pray, sir, take care of the blue child. I'm sure he'll do himself a mischief." She watched him apprehensively as he went down the side, but her eye could not follow, nor her heart conceive his rapid progress from the frigate's deck to the midshipman's berth, where those who had been obliged to stay aboard were sitting down to a feast sent across by the Indiaman. For his part, Jack couldn't manage a second dinner when he reached the Surprise again, nor indeed anything of a solid nature. But throwing off his coat, neckcloth, waistcoat and breeches, he called for nankeen trousers and coffee. "You'll join me in another pot, Stephen," he said. "Lord, how delightful it is to have room to move." The envoy's suite, apart from Mr. White, who was too poor to pay his passage, had removed into an Indiaman, and the great cabin was itself again. "And how glad I am to be shot of that wicked little scrub Atkins. He was a nuisance, but he was not a wicked man. Weak he was, and silly." "When you say weak, you say all the rest. You're much too inclined to find excuses for scrubs, Stephen. You preserved that ill-conditioned brute Scriven from the gallows, nourished him in your bosom, gave him your countenance, and who paid for it? J. Aubrey paid for it. Here's the coffee. After such a dinner, your soul calls out for coffee. A most capital dinner, upon my word. The duck was the best I've ever tasted." "I was sorry to see you help yourself to him a fourth time. Duck is a melancholy meat. In any case, the rich sauce in which it was bathed was not at all the thing for a subject of your corpulence. Apoplexy lurks in dishes of that kind. I signalled to you, but you did not attend. Is that why you were looking so munchant? I was displeased with my neighbours, too. The nymphs in green? Delightful girls. It's clear you've been a great while at sea to call those sandy-haired, coarse-featured, pimply, short-necked, thick-fingered, vulgar-minded, lubricious blockheads by such a name. Nymphs, forsooth. If they were nymphs, they must have had their being in a tolerably rank and stagnant pool. The wench on my left had an ill breath, and turning for a leaf, I found her sister had a worse. And the upper garment of neither was free from reproach. Worse lay below, I make no doubt. "La, sister!" cries the one to the other, breathing across me. "Vile teeth!" And "La, sister!" cries the other. I've no notion of 2 sisters wearing the same clothes, the same flaunting meretricious gauds, the same tortured gorgon curls low over their brutish criminal foreheads. It bespeaks a superfetation of vulgarity, both innate and studiously acquired. And when I think that their teeming loins will people the East... Pray pour me out another cup of coffee. Confident brutes. He might have added that these young ladies had instantly started to talk to him about a Mrs. Villiers of Bombay, who had just reached Calcutta. The doctor must have heard of her in Bombay. She was nothing but an adventuress. How dreadful! They'd seen her at the governor's, dressed very outré. Not at all good-looking. They wondered at the reports. People were obliged to receive her and pretend not to know, because her gentleman friend, say, protector sister, was vastly important, lived in the highest style, quite princely,
It was said she was ruining him. He was a vastly genteel creature, tall, such an air and address, you would almost think he was one of us. He'd looked at Aggie in such a particular way. They both tittered into their balled-up, grubby handkerchiefs, slapping one another behind his bowed back. He was turning it over in his mind whether to say, "These women spoke malignantly about Diana Villas, which angered me. I asked her to marry me in Bombay, and I am to have her reply in Calcutta. I have meant to tell you this for some time. Candor required such a statement earlier. I trust you will forgive my apparent lack of candor." When Jack said, "Well? And so you didn't altogether like them, I collect. I'm sorry for it. My neighbour and I agreed wonderfully well. Muffet, I mean. The girl on my other side was a ninny hammer, no bosom. I thought these girls with no bosoms were exploded long ago. I took to him amazingly, a thoroughgoing seaman, not at all the usual company's commander. Not that I mean to imply they're not seamen, but they are rather pianissimo, if you know what I mean.
I know what pianissimo means.
He has exactly my idea about stepping the royal mast abaft the topgallant with its heel on the top cap. He actually has it rigged so, as I dare say you noticed, and swears it gives him an extra knot in moderate airs. I'm determined to try it. He's an excellent fellow. He promised to put our packet aboard a pilot boat the moment he was in soundings.
I wish you may have desired Sophie to come to Madeira, muttered Stephen.
And he has some notions of gunnery, too, which is rare enough even in the Navy. He does his best to exercise his people, but he's most pitifully equipped, poor fellow.
There seemed to me a formidable array of guns. More than we possess, if I do not mistake.
They were not guns, my poor Stephen. They were cannonades.
What are cannonades?
Why, then, cannonades. Medium 18s. How can I explain? You know a carronade, I'm sure.
Certainly I do. The short thing on slides, ignoble in its proportions, that throws an immense ball. I've noticed several about the ship.
What a lynx you are, upon my honour. Nothing escapes you. And clearly you know a cannon, a great gun. Well now, conceive of an unlucky bastard cross between the two. Something that weighs a mere 2,800 weight and jumps in the air and breaks its breeching every time you offer to fire it, and that will not strike true at 500 yards. No, not at 50. And there you have your cannonade.
But even if the company had some notion of its own interests and gave you real guns, who's to fire them off?
He'd need 350 men, and what's he got? 140. Most of them cooks and stewards. And Lascar cooks and stewards at that. Dear Lord above, what a way to trundle 6 millions about the world. Yet he has sound views on stepping a royal. I'm determined to try it, if only on the foremast. 2 days later, the Surprise, alone on a misty, heaving sea, was trying it. The carpenter and his crew had wrought all morning, and now, dinner having been cut short, the long mast was swaying up through the intricate tracery of the rigging. This was a delicate task in a heavy swell, and Jack had not only heaved to, but he'd stopped the midday grog. He wanted no fuddled enthusiasm heaving on the top rope, and he knew very well that the delay would stimulate zeal, that no one would put up with a moment's dawdling, that no man would presume to pause to gasp in the oppressive, thundery heat for fear of what his mates would do. Up and up it went. And peering with half-closed eyes into the glare of the covered sun, he guided it inch by inch, coordinating the successive heaves with the pitching of the ship. The last half-foot, and the whole ship's company held its breath, eyes fixed on the heel of the mast. It crept
a little higher, the new top rope creaking in the block and sending down a cloud of shakings. Then, with a jerk and a shudder along its whole length, the heel lifted over the top cap. "Handsomely, handsomely," cried Jack. "A trifle more." At the masthead, the boatswain flung up his hand. "Lower away." The top rope slackened. The heel of the mast settled down inside the step, and it was done. The surprises let out a universal sigh. The main topsail and forecourse dropped like the curtain at the end of a harrowing drama. They were sheeted home, and the boatswain piped belay. The frigate answered at once, and as he felt the way on her, Jack gazed up at the new royal mast, rigidly parallel with the t'gallant and rising high above with a splendid promise of elastic strength. He felt a dart of pure joy, not merely because of the mast, nor because of the sweet motion of the ship, his own dear ship, nor yet because he was afloat and in command. It was a plenitude of being... "On deck, there!" called the lookout in a hesitant, deprecating howl. "Sail on the larboard bow! Two, maybe!" Hesitant because reporting the China fleet for a third time was absurd, deprecating because he should have done so long ago instead of staring at the perilous drama of the mast. His hail excited little interest or none. Grog was to be served out the moment the mast was secured and the yard across. Willing hands, well ahead of orders, were busy with the two pair of shrouds, the stoppings on the yard. Impatient men were waiting in the cross-trees, ready to clap on the braces. However, Jack and his first lieutenant looked attentively at the hazy ships, looming unnaturally large some 4 miles ahead, and growing rapidly clearer as the frigate sailed towards them. She was making 5 knots already on the steady northeast wind. "Who is that old-fashioned fellow who carries his mizzen-top mast staysail under the main-top?" said Stoughton. "I believe I can make out 2 more behind them." "I'm astonished they should have come up with us so soon. After all..."
"Stoughton! Stoughton!" cried Jack. "It's Lenoir! Haul your wind! Hard aport! Hard over! Let fall the main course there! Strike the pendant! Forestaysail, main t'gallant! Marines! Marines there! Clap onto the main brace! Bear a hand! Bear a hand! Mr. Etheridge! Stir up your men!"
Babington came running aft to report the fore-royal yard across, and the frigate's sudden turn coinciding with a heavy roll threw him off his balance. He fell sprawling at his captain's feet.
"Butcher!" cried Jack. "Mr. Babington, this is carrying a proper deference too far."
"Yard across, sir, if you please," said Babington,
and seeing the wild glee on Jack's face, the mad brilliance of his eye, he presumed on their old acquaintance to say, "Sir, what's afoot?"
"Lenoir is afoot," said Jack with a grin.
"Mr. Stoughton, backstage to that mast at once and prevent us. Don't let them set up the shrouds too taut. We mustn't have it rung. All stansels and kites into the tops. Give her what sail she can carry, and then I believe you may prepare to clear for action."
Slinging his glass, he ran up the masthead like a boy. The Surprise had spun round on her heel. She was now steadying on her course, close-hauled and heading north, leaning far over the larboard as the sail increased upon her, and her bow-wave began to fling the water wide. The Frenchmen were fading a little in the haze, but he could see the nearest signalling. Both had been sailing on a course designed to intercept the Surprise. They had seen him first, and now they were following his turn in chase. They would never fetch his wake unless they tacked, however. They'd been too far ahead for that. Beyond them he could make out a larger ship, another further to the southwest, and something indistinct on the blurred horizon, perhaps a brig. These three were still sailing large. And clearly the whole squadron had been in line abreast, strung out to sweep 20 miles of sea. And they were standing directly for the path the slow China fleet would traverse next day. Thunder had been grumbling and crashing since the morning. And now in the midst of a distant peal there was the sound of a gun. The Admiral, no doubt, calling in his leeward ships. "Mr. Stourton," he called. "Dutch ensign and 2 or 3 hoists of the first signal flags that come to hand, with a gun to windward. 2 guns. The French frigates were cracking on. T'gallant staysails appeared, outer jib, jib of jibs. They were throwing up a fine bow wave, and the first was making perhaps 8 knots, the second 9. But the distance was drawing out, and that would never do. His very first concern was to find out what he had to deal with. Below him, the deck was like an anthill disturbed, and he could hear the crash of the carpenter's mallets below as the cabin bulkheads came down. It would be some minutes before the apparent confusion resolved itself into a trim, severe pattern, a clean sweep fore and aft, the guns cast loose, their crews standing by them, every man at his station, sentries at the hatchways, damp fear-not screens rigged over the magazines, wet sand strewn over the decks. The men had been through these motions hundreds of times, but never in earnest. How would they behave in action? Pretty well, no doubt. Most men did in this kind of action if they were properly led. And the surprises were a decent set of men. A little over-eager with their shot at first, perhaps, but that could be dealt with. How much powder was there filled? 20 rounds apiece was yesterday's report, and plenty of wads. Hales was a good, conscientious gunner. He'd be as busy as a bee at this moment, down there in the powder room. This drawing away would never do. He would give them another 2 minutes, and then take his measures. The second frigate had passed the first. She was almost certainly the 36-gun Semillante, with 12-pounders on her main deck. The surprise could take her on. He moved out onto the yardarm for a better view, for they lay on his quarter and it was difficult to count the gun ports. Yes, she was the Semillante. And the heavy frigate behind her was the Belle Poule, 40, with 18-pounders. A very tough nut to crack if she was well handled. He watched them dispassionately. Yes, they were well handled. Both somewhat crank, probably from want of stores, and both slow, of course. They must be trailing a great curtain of weed after 70 months in this milk-warm water, and they were making heavy weather of it. Beautiful ships, however, and their people obviously knew their duty. Semillante sheeted home her foretopmast staysail in a flash. In his opinion, Belle Poule would do better with less canvas abroad. Her fore-topgallant seemed to be pressing her down. No doubt her captain knew her trim best. Braithwaite appeared, snorting. "Mr. Stourton's duty, sir, and the ship is cleared for action. Do you choose he should beat to quarter, sir?" "No, Mr. Braithwaite," said Jack, considering. There was no question of action yet a while, and it would be a pity to keep the men standing about. "No, but pray tell him I should like sail to be discreetly reduced. Come up the bowlines a trifle and give the sheets half a fathom or so. Nothing obvious, you understand me? And the old No. 3 foretopsail is to be bent to a hawser and veered out of the lee sternport." "Aye, aye, sir," said Braithwaite, and vanished. A few moments later the frigate's speed began to slacken. And as the strain came onto the drag sail, opening like a parachute beneath the surface, it dropped further still. Stephen and the chaplain stood at the taffrail, staring over the larboard quarter. "I'm afraid they're coming closer," said Mr. White. I can distinctly see the men on the front of the nearer one, and even on the ship behind. See, they fire a gun. And a flag appears. Your glass, if you please. Why, it's the English flag. I congratulate you, Dr. Machin, and I congratulate you on our deliverance. I confess I had apprehended a very real danger, the most unpleasant situation. Ha, ha, ha! They're our friends.